Chapter 3. It turns out they take murder quite seriously at police stations, which I suppose I should have guessed. They've put me in a little room with a table and plastic chairs, and posters about locking your car. They'd given me a cup of tea and a form to fill in, and a policewoman told me a detective would be along in a moment to talk to me. I want to laugh hysterically, or climb out the window. "What am I going to say to a detective?" I exclaim, as soon as the door has closed. "I don't know anything about you. How am I going to say you were murdered? With the candlestick in the drawing room?" Sadie doesn't even seem to have heard me. She's sitting on the window ledge, swinging her legs, although when I look more closely, I notice that she's not actually on the ledge. She's floating about an inch above it. Following my gaze, she sees the gap and flinches with annoyance. She adjusts her position carefully until she looks as though she's sitting right on the ledge, then insouciantly starts swinging her legs again. "She's all in my mind," I tell myself firmly. "Let's be rational here. If my own brain has conjured her up, then my own brain can get rid of her." "Go away," I think as strongly as I can, holding my breath and clenching my fists. "Go away, go away, go away!" Sadie glances over me and gives a sudden giggle. "You do look peculiar," she says. "Do you have a pain in your stomach?" I'm about to make a retort when the door opens, and my stomach really does twinge. It's a detective, wearing plain clothes, which makes it almost more scary than if he was in uniform. Oh, God, I am in such trouble.
"Horror."
The detective holds out his hand. He's tall and broad, with dark hair and a brisk manner.
"D.I. James."
"Hi." My voice is squeaky with nerves. "Nice to meet you."
"So?"
He sits down in a businesslike way and takes out a pen.
"I understand you stopped your great-aunt's funeral."
"That's right." I nod with as much conviction as I can muster. "I just think there was something suspicious about her death." D.I. James makes a note, then looks up.
"Why?"
I stare blankly back at him, my heart pounding. I have no answer. I should have made something up very quickly. I'm an idiot. "Well, don't you think it suspicious?" I improvise at last. "Her just dying like that? I mean, people don't just die out of the blue." D.I. James regards me with an unreadable expression.
"I believe she was 105 years old."
"So what?" I retort, gaining confidence. "Can't people of 105 be murdered too? I didn't think the police were so ageist." D.I. James's face flickers, whether with amusement or annoyance I can't tell.
"Who do you think murdered your great-aunt?"
he says. "It was..." I rub my nose, playing for time. "It's rather complicated." I glance helplessly up at Sadie. "You're useless," she cries. "You need a story or they won't believe you. They won't delay the funeral any longer. Say it was the staff at the nursing home. Say you heard them plotting." "No," I exclaim in shock before I can help myself. D.I. James gives me an odd look and clears his throat.
"Laura, do you have a genuine reason for believing something was amiss with your great-aunt's death?"
"Say it was the staff at the nursing home."
Sadie's voice is in my ear like a screeching brake.
"Say it. Say it. Say it."
"It was the staff at the nursing home," I blurt out in desperation. "I think."
"What grounds do you have for saying this?"
D.I. James's tone is even, but his eyes are alert. In front of him, Sadie is hovering, glowering at me and wheeling her hands around as though to crank the words out of me. The sight is totally freaking me out.
I overheard them whispering in the pub. Something about poison and insurance. I thought nothing of it at the time.
I swallow feebly.
But the next moment, my great-aunt's dead.
I've lifted this entire plot from a daytime soap opera that I watched last month when I was off sick, I abruptly realize. D.I. James gives me a penetrating look.
You would testify to this?
Oh, God. Testify is one of those very scary words, like tax inspector and lumbar puncture. I cross my fingers under the table and gulp. Yes.
Did you see these people?
No.
What's the name of the nursing home? What area is it in?
I stare back at him steadily. I have no idea. I glance up at Sadie, who has her eyes closed, as though recalling something from a long, long way away. Fairside, she says slowly. In Potter's Bar. Fairside. Potter's Bar, I repeat. There's a short silence. D.I. James has finished writing and is flicking his pen backward and forward.
I'm just going to consult with a colleague.
He stands up.
I'll be back in a minute.
The moment he's left the room, Sadie gives me a contemptuous look. Is that the best you could do? He'll never believe you. You were supposed to be helping me by accusing random people of murder. Don't be such a goose, she says dismissively. You didn't accuse anyone by name. In fact, your story was utterly hopeless. Poison? Whispered conversations in pubs? You try making something up on the spot, I reply defensively. And that's not the point. The point is we need to delay my funeral. She's suddenly about 2 inches away from me, her eyes intense and pleading. It can't happen. You can't let it. Not yet. But I blink in surprise as she disappears right before my eyes. God, this is annoying. I feel like I'm Alice in Wonderland. Any minute she'll reappear with a flamingo under her arm, shouting, "Off with her head!" Leaning gingerly back in my chair, half expecting that to disappear too, I blink a few times, trying to process everything. But it's too surreal. I'm sitting in a police station, inventing a murder, being bossed around by a non-existent phantom girl. I never even got any lunch, it occurs to me. Maybe this is all due to low blood sugar. Maybe I'm diabetic and this is the first sign. My mind feels like it's tying itself up in knots. Nothing makes any sense. There's no point trying to work out what's going on. I'll just have to go with the flow. They're going to pursue it. Sadie appears again, speaking so fast I can barely follow her. They think you're probably deluded, but they're going to follow it up anyway, just in case. Really? I say incredulously. That policeman's been talking to another policeman, she explains breathlessly. I followed them. He showed him your notes and said, got a right one here. A right one? I can't help echoing indignantly. Sadie ignores me. But then they started talking about some other nursing home where there was a murder. Sounds too ghastly. And one policeman said maybe they should put in a phone call just in case, and the other agreed. So we're all right. All right. You may be all right, but I'm not. As the door swings open, Sadie adds quickly, ask the policeman what's going to be done about the funeral. Ask him, ask him. That's not my problem, I begin, then hastily stop as D.I. James's head appears around the door.
Laura, I'm going to ask a detective constable to take a statement from you. Then we'll decide how to progress.
Thanks. I'm aware of Sadie glaring meaningfully at me. And what will happen to... I hesitate. How does it work with the... body?
The body will be kept at the mortuary for now. If we decide to proceed with an investigation, it will remain there until we file a report to the coroner, who will demand an inquest, should the evidence be sufficiently credible and consistent.
He nods briskly, then heads out. As the door closes, I subside. I'm suddenly feeling shaky all over. I've invented a murder story to a real policeman. This is the worst thing I've ever done. Even worse than the time I ate half a packet of biscuits aged 8, and rather than confess to Mum, hid the whole biscuit tin in the garden behind the rose bush and had to watch her search the kitchen for it. You realize I've just committed perjury, I say to Sadie. You realize they might arrest me. They might arrest me, Sadie echoes mockingly. She's perched on the window ledge again. Have you never been arrested before?
Of course I haven't,
I goggle at her. Have you?
Several times, she says airily.
The first time was for dancing in the village fountain one night. It was too funny. She starts to giggle. We had some mock handcuffs, you know, as part of a fancy dress costume. And while the policeman was hauling me out of the pond, my friend Bunty locked her handcuffs round him as a lock. He was livid. She's in paroxysms of laughter by now. God, she's annoying. I'm sure it was hilarious. I shoot her a baleful look. But personally, I'd rather not go to jail and catch some hideous disease, thank you. Well, you wouldn't have to if you had a better story. Her laughter stops. I've never seen such a ninny. You weren't credible or consistent. At this rate, they won't even proceed with the investigation. We won't have any time. Time for what? Time to find my necklace, of course. I drop my head down on the table with a clunk. She doesn't give up, does she? Look, I say at last, raising my head an inch. Why do you need this necklace so badly? Why this one particular necklace? Was it a present or something? For a moment she's silent, her eyes distant. The only movement in the room is her feet, swinging rhythmically back and forth. It was a present from my parents for my 21st birthday, she says at last. I was happy when I wore it. Well, that's nice, I say, but I had it all my life. I wore it all my life. She sounds suddenly agitated. No matter what else I lost, I kept that. It's the most important thing I ever had. I need it. She's fidgeting with her hands, her face tilted down so all I can see is the corner of her chin. She's so thin and pale, she looks like a drooping flower. I feel a pang of sympathy for her, and am about to say, "Of course I'll find your necklace," when she yawns elaborately, stretching her skinny arms above her head and says, "This is too dull. I wish we could go to a nightclub." I glare at her, all my sympathy gone. Is this the gratitude I get? If you're so bored, I say, we can go and finish your funeral if you like. Sadie claps a hand over her mouth and gasps. You wouldn't. I might. A knock at the door interrupts us, and a jolly-looking woman in a dark shirt and trousers puts her head around it. Lara Lington. An hour later, I finished giving my so-called statement. I've never had such a traumatic experience in my life. What a shambles. First, I forgot the name of the nursing home. Then I got my timings all wrong and had to convince the policewoman it had taken me 5 minutes to walk half a mile. I ended up saying I was training to be a professional speedwalker. Just thinking about it makes me cringy and hot. There's no way she believed me. I mean, do I look like a professional speedwalker? Then I said I'd been to my friend Linda's before visiting the pub. I don't even have a friend called Linda. I just didn't want to mention any of my real friends. She wanted Linda's surname, and I blurted out Davis before I could stop myself. Of course, I'd read it off the top of the form. She was D.C. Davis. At least I didn't say Kaiser Soze. To her credit, the policewoman didn't flicker. Nor did she say whether they would proceed with the case. She just thanked me politely and found me the number of a cab firm. I'll probably go to jail now. Great. All I need. I glower at Sadie, who's lying full length on the desk, staring up at the ceiling. It really didn't help having her in my ear the whole time, constantly correcting me and adding suggestions, and reminiscing about the time two policemen tried to stop her and Bunty racing their motors over the fields and couldn't catch up with them. It was too funny. You're welcome, I say. Again.
Thank you.
Sadie's voice drifts idly over. Right, well, I pick up my bag. I'm off. In one quick movement, Sadie sits up.
You won't forget my necklace, will you?
I doubt I will, my entire life. I roll my eyes. However hard I try. Suddenly she's in front of me, blocking my way to the door. No one can see me except you. No one else can help me. Please. Look, you can't just say, "Find my necklace," I exclaim in exasperation. I don't know anything about it. I don't know what it looks like. It's made of glass beads with rhinestones, she says eagerly. It falls to here. She gestures at her waist. The clasp is inlaid mother-of-pearl. Right, I cut her off. Well, I haven't seen it. If it turns up, I'll let you know. I swing past her, push the door open into the police station foyer, and take out my phone. The foyer is brightly lit, with a grubby linoleum floor and a desk, which right now is empty. Two huge guys in hoodies are having a loud argument while a policeman is trying to calm them down, and I back away to what looks like a safe corner. I get out the minicab firm number DC Davies gave me and start keying it into my phone. I can see there are about 20 voice messages on there, but I ignore them all. It'll just be Mum and Dad, stressing away.
Hey!
A voice interrupts me and I pause midway through.
Lara, is that you?
A guy with sandy hair in a polo neck and jeans is waving at me.
It's me, Mark Phillipson. Sixth Form College.
Mark! I exclaim, suddenly recognizing him. Oh, my God! How are you doing? The only thing I remember about Mark is him playing bass guitar in the college band.
I'm fine. Great.
He comes across with a concerned expression.
What are you doing at the police station? Is everything okay?
Oh, yes, I'm fine. I'm just here for a, you know. I wave it off. Murder thing.
Murder?
He looks staggered. Yeah. But it's no big deal. I mean, obviously it is a big deal. I correct myself hastily at his expression. I'd better not say too much about it. Anyway, how are you doing?
Great. Married to Anna. Remember her?
He flashes a silver wedding ring.
Trying to make it as a painter. I do this stuff on the side.
You're a policeman, I say disbelievingly, and he laughs.
Police artist. People describe the villains. I draw them. It pays the rent. So, how about you, Lara? Are you married? With somebody?
For a moment, I just stare back with a rictor smile. I was with this guy for a while, I say at last. It didn't work out. But I'm fine about it now. I'm in a really good place, actually. I've clenched my plastic cup so hard it's cracked. Mark looks a bit disconcerted.
Well, see you, Lara.
He lifts a hand.
Will you be okay getting home?
I'm calling a cab, I nod. Thanks. Nice to bump into you. Don't let him go. Sadie's voice in my ear makes me jump out of my skin. He can help. Shut up and leave me alone, I mutter out of the corner of my mouth, shooting an even brighter smile at Mark. Bye, Mark. Give my love to Anna. He can draw the necklace. Then you'll know what you're looking for. She's suddenly right in front of me. Ask him quickly. No. Ask him! Her banshee voice is coming back, piercing my eardrum. Ask him, ask him, ask him! Oh, for God's sake, she's going to drive me insane. Mark, I call, so loudly that the two guys in hoodies stop fighting and stare at me. I've got this tiny favour to ask you, if you have a moment.
Sure.
Mark shrugs. We go into a side room with cups of tea from the machine. We pull up chairs to a table, and Mark gets out his paper and artist's pencils.
So?
He raises his eyebrows.
A necklace. That's a new one.
I saw it once at an antiques fair, I improvise, and I'd love to commission one like it, but I'm so bad at drawing things, and it suddenly occurred to me that maybe you could help.
No problem. Fire away.
Mark takes a sip of tea, his pencil poised over the paper, and I glance up at Sadie. It was made of beads, she says, holding up her hands as though she can almost feel it. two rows of glass beads, almost translucent. It's two rows of beads, I say, almost translucent.
Uh-huh.
He nods, already sketching circular beads.
Like this?
More oval, says Sadie, peering over his shoulder. Longer, and there were rhinestones in between. The beads were more oval, I say apologetically, with rhinestones in between.
No problem.
Mark is already rubbing out and sketching longer beads.
Like this?
I glance up at Sadie. She's watching him, mesmerized. And the dragonfly, she murmurs. You mustn't forget the dragonfly. For another 5 minutes, Mark sketches, rubs out and sketches again, as I relay Sadie's comments. Slowly, gradually, the necklace comes alive on the page. That's it, says Sadie at last. Her eyes are shining as she gazes down. That's my necklace. Perfect, I say to Mark. You've got it. For a moment, we all survey it in silence.
Nice,
says Mark at last, jerking his head at it.
Unusual. Reminds me of something.
He frowns at the sketch for a moment, then shakes his head.
No, lost it.
He glances at his watch.
I'm afraid I have to dash.
That's fine, I say quickly. Thanks so much. When he's gone, I pick up the paper and look at the necklace. It's very pretty, I have to admit. Long rows of glassy beads, sparkling rhinestones, and a big ornamental pendant in the shape of a dragonfly, studded with even more rhinestones. So this is what we're looking for. Yes. Sadie looks up, her face full of animation. Exactly. Where shall we start? You have to be joking. I reach for my jacket and stand up. I'm not looking for anything now. I'm going home and having a nice glass of wine. And then I'm having a chicken korma with naan. Newfangled modern food, I explain, noticing her bemused expression. And then I'm going to bed. So what shall I do? Says Sadie, looking suddenly deflated. I don't know. I head out of the side room back into the foyer. A taxi is offloading an elderly couple onto the pavement outside, and I hurry out calling, Taxi! Can you take me to Kilburn? As the taxi moves off, I spread out the sketch on my lap and look at the necklace again, trying to imagine it in real life. Sadie described the beads as a kind of pale yellow iridescent glass. Even in the drawing, the rhinestones are sparkling all over. The real thing must be stunning. Worth a bit, too. Just for a moment, I feel a flicker of excitement at the thought of actually finding it. But an instant later, sanity checks back into my brain. I mean, it probably doesn't exist. And even if it did, the chances of finding some random necklace belonging to a dead old lady who probably lost it or broke it years ago are approximately 3 million to 1. No, 3 billion to 1. At last I fold the paper and tuck it in my bag, then flop back on my seat. I don't know where Sadie is, and I don't care. I close my eyes, ignoring the constant vibrations of my mobile phone, and let myself doze off. What a day! Chapter 4. The next day, the sketch of the necklace is all I have left. Sadie has disappeared, and the whole episode feels like a dream. At 8:30, I'm sitting at my desk, sipping coffee and staring down at the picture. What on earth got into me yesterday? The entire thing must have been my brain cracking up under the strain. The necklace, the girl, the banshee wailing. It was obviously all a figment of my imagination. For the first time, I'm starting to sympathize with my parents. I'm worried about me too. Hi! There's a crash as Kate, our assistant, swings open the door, knocking over a bunch of files, which I'd put on the floor while I got the milk out of the fridge. We don't have the biggest office in the world. So, how was the funeral? Kate hangs up her coat, leaning right back over the photocopier to reach her hook. Luckily, she's quite gymnastic. Not great. In fact, I ended up at the police station. I had this weird mental flip-out. God! Kate looks horrified. Are you okay? Yeah, I mean, I think so. I have to get a grip. Abruptly, I fold up the necklace sketch, thrust it into my bag and zip it shut. Actually, I knew something was up. Kate pauses halfway through twisting her blonde hair into an elastic. Your dad called yesterday afternoon and asked me if you'd been particularly stressed recently. I look up in alarm. You didn't tell him about Natalie leaving? No, of course not. Kate has been well trained in what to divulge to my parents, i.e. nothing. Anyway, I say with more vigour, never mind. I'm fine now. Were there any messages? Yes. Kate reaches for her notebook with a super efficient manner. Shireen kept calling all yesterday. She's going to call you today. Great! Shireen is our one piece of good news at LNN Executive Recruitment. We recently placed her as Operations Director at a software company, Macrosant. In fact, she's about to start the job next week. She's probably just calling to thank us. Anything else? I say, just as the phone rings. Kate checks the caller ID and her eyes widen. Oh, yes, another thing, she says hurriedly. Janet from Leonidas Sports called, wanting an update. She said she was going to ring at 9 a.m. sharp. This'll be her. She meets my panicky eyes. Do you want me to answer? No, I want to hide under the desk. Yes, you'd better. My stomach is bubbling with nerves. Leonidas Sports is our biggest client. They're a massive sports equipment company with shops all over the UK, and we've promised to find them a marketing director. Rephrase that. Natalie promised to find them a marketing director. I'll just put you through, Kate is saying in her best PA voice, and a moment later the phone on my desk rings. I glance desperately at Kate, then pick it up. Janet, I exclaim in my most confident tones. Good to hear from you. I was just about to call.
Hi, Lara,
comes Janet Grady's familiar, hoarse voice.
Just phoning for an update. I was hoping to speak to Natalie.
I've never met Janet Grady face to face, but in my head, she's about 6'3" with a moustache. The first time we ever spoke, she told me the team at Leonidas Sports are all tough thinkers, hard players, and have an iron grip on the market. They sound terrifying. Oh, right. I twist the phone cord around my fingers. Well, unfortunately, Natalie's still, poorly. This is the story I've been spinning ever since Natalie didn't make it back from Goa. Luckily, you just have to say, she's been to India, and everyone launches into their own my horrendous travelling illness story without asking any more questions. But we're making great headway, I continue. Really marvellous. We're working through the long list, and there's a file of very strong candidates right here on my desk. We'll be looking at a top-class shortlist, I can assure you. All tough thinkers.
Can you give me any names?
Not right now. My voice jumps in panic. I'll fill you in nearer the time, but you'll be very impressed.
Okay, Lara.
Janet is one of those women who never waste time on small talk.
Well, as long as you're on top of it. Best to Natalie. Goodbye.
I replace the receiver and meet Kate's eyes, my heart thumping. Remind me, who do we have as possibles for Leonidas Sports?
The guy with a 3-year gap in his resume, says Kate, and the weirdo with the dandruff, and the kleptomaniac woman.
I wait for her to continue. She gives a tiny apologetic shrug. That's all.
Paul Richards pulled out yesterday, she says anxiously. He's been offered a position at some American company. Here's the list.
She hands me the sheet of paper, and I stare at the three names in total despair. They're all no-hopers. We can't send this list in. God, headhunting is hard. I had no idea. Before we started up the company, Natalie always made it seem so exciting. She talked about the thrill of the chase, strategic hiring and upskilling and The tap on the shoulder. We used to meet every few weeks for a drink, and she was full of such amazing stories about her work, I couldn't help feeling envious. Writing promotional website copy for a car manufacturer seemed really dull in comparison. Plus, there were rumors we were going to have big layoffs. So when Natalie suggested a start-up, I jumped at the chance. The truth is, I've always been a bit in awe of Natalie. She's so glossy and confident. Even when we were at school, she always had the latest slang and could blag us into pubs. And when we first started off the company, it all worked brilliantly. She brought in some big bits of business for us at once and was constantly out networking. I was writing our website and supposedly learning all the tricks from her. It was all going in the right direction. Until she disappeared, and I realized I hadn't actually learned any tricks at all. Natalie's really into business mantras, and they're all on post-its around her desk. I keep sidling over and studying them, as if they're the runes to some ancient religion, trying to divine what I'm meant to do. For example, the best talent is already in the market is stuck up above her computer. That one I do know. It means you're not supposed to go through the resumes of all the bankers who were fired from an investment bank last week and try to make them sound like marketing directors. You're supposed to go after existing marketing directors. But how? What if they won't even speak to you? After doing this job for several weeks on my own, I have a few new mantras, which go as follows. The best talent doesn't answer the phone itself. The best talent doesn't ring back, even if you leave 3 messages with its secretary. The best talent doesn't want to move into sports retail. When you mention the 50% employee discount on tennis rackets, the best talent just laughs at you. I pull out our original, crumpled, coffee-stained long list for the millionth time and flick through it gloomily. Names glitter off the page like shiny sweeties. Employed, bona fide talent. The marketing director of Woodhouse Retail. The European marketing head at Dartmouth Plastics. They can't all be happy at their jobs, surely. There must be someone out there who would love to work for Leonidas Sports. But I've tried every single name and got nowhere. I glance up to see Kate standing on one foot, surveying me anxiously, the other leg wrapped around her calf. We have precisely 3 weeks to find a tough-thinking, hard-hitting marketing director for Leonidas Sports. I'm trying desperately to stay positive. Natalie landed this deal. Natalie was going to woo all the starry candidates. Natalie knows how to do this. I don't. Anyway, no point dwelling on that now. Okay, I slap my hand on the desk. I'm going to make some calls. I'll make you a fresh coffee. Kate springs into action. We'll stay here all night if we have to. I love Kate. She acts like she's in a film about some really thrusting multinational company, instead of 2 people in a 10-foot square office with mouldy carpet. Salary, 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 she says as she sits down. You snooze, you lose, I respond. Kate got into reading Natalie's mantras too. Now we can't stop quoting them at each other. The trouble is, they don't actually tell you how to do the job. What I need is the mantra telling you how to get past the question, may I ask what it is in connection with? I swing my chair over to Natalie's desk to get out all the Leonidas Sports paperwork. The cardboard file has fallen off its hangers inside her drawer, so with a muttered curse, I gather all the papers together and pull them out. Then suddenly I stop, as I notice an old post-it, which has somehow attached itself to my hand. I've never seen this before. James Yates, Mobile, is written in faded purple felt tip. And then a number. A mobile number for James Yates? I don't believe it. He's marketing director at Felton's Breweries. He's on the long list. He'd be perfect. Whenever I've tried his office, I've been told he's abroad. But wherever he is, he'll have his mobile, won't he? Trembling with excitement, I push my chair back to my own desk and dial the number.
James Yates?
The line is a little crackly, but I can still hear him. Hi, I say, trying to sound as confident as possible. It's Lara Linton here. Can you talk? This is what Natalie always says on the phone. I've heard her.
Who is this?
He sounds suspicious.
Did you say you're from Linkton's?
I give an inward sigh. No, I'm from L&N Executive Recruitment, and I was phoning to see if you'd be interested in a new position, heading up marketing in a dynamic, growing retail company. It's a very exciting opportunity, so if you'd like to discuss it, perhaps over a discreet lunch at a restaurant of your choice. I'm going to die if I don't breathe, so I stop and gasp for air.
L&N?
He sounds wary.
I don't know you.
We're a relatively new outfit. Myself and Natalie Massa.
Not interested.
He cuts me off. It's a marvellous opportunity, I say quickly. You'll have a chance to expand your horizons. There's a lot of exciting potential in Europe.
Sorry, goodbye.
And a 10% discount on sportswear. I call desperately down the dead phone. He's gone. He didn't even give me a chance. What did he say? Kate approaches, her hands clutched hopefully around a coffee cup. He hung up. I slump in my chair as Kate puts down the coffee. We're never going to get anyone good. Yes, we will, says Kate, just as the phone starts ringing. Maybe this is some brilliant executive who's longing for a new job. She hurries back to her desk and picks up the phone with her best assistant's manner. L&N Executive Recruitment. Oh, Shireen, great to hear from you. I'll put you through to Lara. She beams at me and I grin back. At least we've had one triumph. I suppose, strictly speaking, it was Natalie's triumph, since she made the placement, but I've been doing all the follow-up work. Anyway, it's a company triumph. Hi, Shireen, I say cheerfully. All set for the new job? I just know it's going to be a great position for you. Lara, Shireen interrupts tensely. There's a problem. My stomach plunges. No, no, please, no problems. Problem? I force myself to sound relaxed. What kind of problem? It's my dog. Your dog? I'm intending to take Flash into work every day, but I just phoned Human Resources about setting up a basket for him, and they said it was impossible. They said it wasn't their policy to allow animals in the offices. Can you believe it? She clearly expects me to be as outraged as she is. I stare at the phone in bewilderment. How has a dog suddenly entered the picture? Lara, are you there? Yes, I come too. Shireen, listen to me. I'm sure you're really fond of Flash, but it's not usual to take dogs into the workplace. Yes, it is, she interrupts. There's another dog in the building. I've heard it every time I've been in. That's why I assumed it would be fine. I never would have taken this job otherwise. They're discriminating against me. I'm sure they're not discriminating, I say hurriedly. I'll call them straight away. I put down the phone, then quickly dial the HR department at Macrosant. Hi, Jean. It's Lara Linkton here, from L&N Executive Recruitment. I just wanted to clarify a small point. Is Shireen Moore permitted to bring her dog to work? The whole building has a no-dog policy, says Jean pleasantly. I'm sorry, Lara, it's an insurance thing. Of course, absolutely, I understand. I pause. The thing is, Shireen believes she's heard another dog in the building. Several times. She's mistaken, Jean says after the tiniest of beats. There are no dogs here. None at all. Not even one little puppy. My suspicions have been aroused by that pause. Not even one little puppy. Jean has regained her smoothness. As I say, there's a no-dog policy in the building. And you couldn't make an exception for Shireen? I'm afraid not. She's polite but implacable. Well, thanks for your time. I put the phone down and tap my pencil silently on my notepad for a few seconds. Something's up. I bet there is a dog there. But what can I do about it? I can't exactly phone Jean back and say, I don't believe you. With a sigh, I redial Shireen's number. Lara, is that you? She picks up straight away, as though she's been sitting by the phone waiting for an answer, which she probably has. She's very bright, Shireen, and very intense. I can picture her now, drawing that endless crisscross of squares which she obsessively doodles everywhere. She probably needs a dog, just to stay sane. Yes, it's me. I called Jean, and she says no one else in the building has a dog. She says it's an insurance thing. There's silence as Shireen digests this. She's lying, she says at last. There is a dog in there. Shireen, I feel like banging my head against the desk. Couldn't you have mentioned the dog before? At one of the interviews, maybe? I assumed it would be okay, she says defensively. I heard the other dog barking. You can tell when there's a dog in a place. Well, I'm not working without Flash. I'm sorry, Lara. I'll have to pull out of the job. No, I cry out in dismay before I can stop myself. I mean, please don't do anything rash, Shireen. I'll sort this out, I promise. I'll call you soon. Breathing heavily, I put the phone down and bury my head in my hands. Crap! What are you going to do? Ventures Kate anxiously. She clearly overheard the whole thing. I don't know, I admit. What would Natalie do? Both of us instinctively glance toward Natalie's desk, gleaming and empty. I have a sudden vision of Natalie sitting there, her lacquered nails tapping on the desk, her voice raised in some high-octane call. Since she's been gone, the volume level in this office has dropped by about 80%. She might tell Shireen she had to take the job and threaten to sue her if she didn't, says Kate at last. She'd definitely tell Shireen to get over herself, I nod in agreement. She'd call her unprofessional and flaky. I once heard Natalie tearing a strip off some guy who had second thoughts about taking up a position in Dubai. It wasn't pretty. The deep-down truth, which I don't want to admit to anyone, is that now I've got to know the way Natalie thinks and does business, I don't really relate to a lot of it. What appealed to me about this job was working with people, changing lives. When we used to meet up, and Natalie would tell me her stories of finding talent, I was always just as interested in the story behind the deal as the deal itself. I thought it must be so much more satisfying to help people's careers than to sell cars. But that aspect doesn't seem to feature highly on our agenda. I mean, okay, I know I'm a novice, and maybe I am a bit idealistic, like Dad always says. But your job is one of the most important things in your life, surely. It should be right for you. Salary isn't everything. There again, that'll be why Natalie's the successful headhunter with loads of commission under her belt, and I'm not. And right now we need commission. So what we're saying is, I should ring Shireen back and give her a hard time, I say reluctantly. There's silence. Kate looks as pained as I feel. Thing is, Lara, she says hesitantly, you're not Natalie. She's away. So you're the boss. So you should do things your way. Yes, I feel a surge of relief. That's true. I'm the boss. So what I say is, I'll think about it for a while first. Trying to look as though this is a decisive piece of action instead of a cop-out, I push the phone aside and start leafing through the post. A bill for office paper. An offer to send all my staff on a team-building trip to Aspen. And, at the bottom of the pile, business people, which is like the celebrity magazine of business. I open it and start flipping through the pages, trying to find someone who would make a perfect marketing director for Leonidas Sports. Business people is essential reading for a headhunter. It's basically endless photo spreads of thrusting, super-groomed types who have massive offices with plenty of space to hang up their coats. But God, it's depressing. As I turn from one high flyer to another, my spirits sink lower and lower. What's wrong with me? I speak only one language. I haven't been asked to chair any international committees. I don't have a working wardrobe which pairs Dolce & Gabbana trouser suits with quirky shirts from Paul Smith. Dolefully, I close the magazine and slump back, staring at the grimy ceiling. How do they all do it? My Uncle Bill, everyone in this magazine. They decide to run a business, and it's instantly a success. And it looks so easy. Yes. Yes. Suddenly I become aware of Kate making semaphore signals across the room. I look up to see her face all pink with excitement as she talks on the phone. I'm sure Lara would be able to make space for you in her schedule, if you could just hold on a moment. She presses hold and squeaks, It's Clive Hoxton, the one who said he wasn't interested in Leonidas Sports. She adds at my blank look, The rugby guy? Well, he might be after all. He wants to have lunch and talk about it. Oh, my God! Him! My spirits shoot back up. Clive Hoxton is marketing director at Arbury Stores and used to play rugby for Doncaster. He couldn't be more perfect for the Leonidas Sports job, but when I first approached him, he said he didn't want to move. I can't believe he's got in touch. Play it cool, I whisper urgently. Pretend I'm really busy interviewing other candidates. Kate nods vigorously. Let me just see, she says into the phone. Lara's schedule is very packed today, but I'll see what I can do. Ah, now what a stroke of luck. She unexpectedly has a vacancy. Would you like to name a restaurant? She grins broadly at me, and I give her an air high five. Clive Hoxton is an A-list name. He's tough-thinking and hard-playing. He'll totally make up for the weirdo and the kleptomaniac. In fact, if we get him, I'll axe the kleptomaniac, I decide. And the weirdo isn't that bad, if we could just get rid of his dandruff. All fixed up. Kate puts the phone down. You're having lunch today at 1 o'clock. Excellent. Where? Well, that's the only thing. Kate hesitates. I asked him to name a restaurant, and he named... She breaks off. What? My heart starts to thump anxiously. Not Gordon Ramsay. Not that posh one in Claridge's. Kate winces. Worse. Lyle Place. My insides shrivel. You have to be kidding. Lyle Place opened about 2 years ago and was instantly christened the most expensive restaurant in Europe. It has a massive lobster tank and a fountain, and loads of celebrities go there. Obviously, I've never been there. I've just read about it in the Evening Standard. We should never, never, never have let him name the restaurant. I should have named it. I would have named Pasta Pot, which is around the corner and does a set lunch for £12.95, including a glass of wine. I don't even think how much lunch for two at Lyle Place is going to be. We won't be able to get in, I say in sudden relief. It'll be too busy. He said he can get a reservation. He knows some people. He'll put it in your name. Damn. Kate is nibbling at her thumbnail anxiously. How much is in the client entertainment, Kitty? About 50 pence, I say in despair. We're broke. I'll have to use my own credit card. Well, it'll be worth it, says Kate resolutely. It's an investment. You've got to look like a mover and a shaker. If people see you eating at Lyle Place, they'll think, Wow, Lara Lington must be doing well if she can afford to take clients here. But I can't afford it, I wail. Could we phone him up and change it to a cup of coffee? Even as I'm saying it, I know how lame this would look. If he wants lunch, I have to give him lunch. If he wants to go to Lyle Place, we have to go to Lyle Place. Maybe it isn't as expensive as we think, says Kate hopefully. I mean, all the newspapers keep saying how bad the economy is, don't they? Maybe they've reduced the prices or got a special offer. That's true. And maybe he won't order very much, I add in sudden inspiration. I mean, he's sporty. He won't be a big eater. Of course he won't, agrees Kate. He'll have, like, one tiny bit of sashimi and some water and dash off, and he definitely won't drink. Nobody drinks at lunch anymore. I'm feeling more positive about this already. Kate's right. No one drinks at business lunches these days, and we can keep it down to 2 courses, or even 1. A starter and a nice cup of coffee. What's wrong with that? And anyway, whatever we eat, it can't cost that much, can it? Oh, my God. I think I'm going to faint. Except I can't, because Clive Hoxton has just asked me to run through the specs of the job again. I'm sitting on a transparent chair at a white-clothed table. If I look to my right, I can see the famous giant lobster tank, which has crustaceans of all sorts clambering around on rocks and occasionally being scooped out in a metal net by a man on a ladder. Over to the left is a cage of exotic birds, whose cheeping is mingling with the background whooshing sound from the fountain in the middle of the room. Well, my voice is quite faint. As you know, Leonidas Sports has just taken over a Dutch chain. I'm talking on autopilot. My eyes keep darting down to the menu, printed on plexiglass. Every time I spot a price, I feel a fresh swoop of horror. Ceviche of salmon, origami style, £34. That's a starter. A starter! Half a dozen oysters, £46. There's no special offer. There's no sign of any hard times. All around, diners are merrily eating and drinking as if this is all totally normal. Are they all bluffing? Are they all secretly quailing inside? If I stood on a chair and yelled, "It's too expensive! I'm not going to take this anymore!" would I start a mass walkout? Obviously the board wants a new marketing director who can oversee this expansion. I have no idea what I'm blabbering about. I'm psyching myself up to peek at the main courses. Fillet of duck with three-way orange mash. £59. My stomach lurches again. I keep doing mental math and reaching 300 and feeling a bit sick.
Some mineral water?
The waiter appears at the table and proffers a blue-tinted plexiglass square to each of us.
This is our water menu. If you like a sparkling water, the Chetwynd Glen is rather fun, he adds. It's filtered through volcanic rock and has a subtle alkalinity.
Ah, I force myself to nod intelligently, and the waiter meets my eyes without a flicker. Surely they all get back into the kitchen, collapse against the walls and start snorting with laughter.
She paid £15 for water. I'd prefer Pellegrino.
Clive shrugs. He's a guy in his 40s with greying hair, froggy eyes and a moustache, and he hasn't smiled once since we sat down.
A bottle of each, then?
Says the waiter. No, not two bottles of overpriced water. So, what would you like to eat, Clive? I smile. If you're in a hurry, we could go straight to main courses.
I'm not in any hurry.
Clive gives me a suspicious look.
Are you?
Of course not. I backtrack quickly. No hurry at all. I wave a generous hand. Have whatever you'd like. Not the oysters. Please, 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 not the oysters.
The oysters, to begin with,
he says thoughtfully.
Then I'm torn between the lobster and the porcini risotto.
I discreetly whip my eyes down to the menu. The lobster is £90. The risotto only £45. Tough choice. I try to sound casual. You know, risotto is always my favourite. There's silence as Clive frowns at the menu again. I love Italian food, I throw in with a relaxed little laugh. And I bet the porcini are delicious. But it's up to you, Clive.
If you can't decide, the waiter puts in helpfully, I could bring you both the lobster and a reduced-size risotto.
He could what? He could what? Who asked him to interfere anyway? Great idea! My voice is two notes shriller than I intended. Two main courses. Why not? I feel the waiter's sardonic eye on me, and instantly know he can read my thoughts. He knows I'm skint.
And for madam?
Right, absolutely. I run a finger down the menu with a thoughtful frown. The truth is, I went for a big power breakfast this morning, so I'll just have a Caesar salad. No starter.
One Caesar salad, no starter.
The waiter nods impassively. And would you like to stick to water, Clive? I desperately try to keep any hint of hope out of my voice. Or wine? Even the idea of the wine list makes my spine feel all twingy with fear.
Let's see the list.
Clive's eyes light up.
And a glass of vintage champagne to start, perhaps,
suggests the waiter with a bland smile. He couldn't just suggest champagne. He had to suggest vintage champagne. This waiter is a total sadist.
I could be persuaded.
Clive gives a sort of lugubrious chuckle, and somehow I force myself to join in. At last the waiter departs, having poured us each a zillion-pound glass of vintage champagne. I feel a bit giddy. I'm going to be paying off this lunch for the rest of my life, but it'll be worth it. I have to believe that. So, I say brightly, raising my glass, to the job. I'm so glad you've changed your mind, Clive.
I haven't,
he says, swigging about half of his champagne down in one gulp. I stare at him, unnerved. Am I going mad? Did Kate take down the message wrong? But I thought...
It's a possibility.
He starts to break up a bread roll.
I'm not happy with my job at the moment, and I'm considering a move. But there are drawbacks to this Leonidas sports gig, too. Sell it to me.
For a moment I'm too choked with dismay to answer. I'm spending the price of a small car on this man, and he might not even be interested in the job. I take a sip of water, then look up, forcing my most professional smile. I can be Natalie. I can sell this to him. Clive, you're not happy in your current post. For a man with your gifts, this is a criminal situation. Look at you. You should be in a place which will appreciate you. I pause, my heart thumping hard. He's listening attentively. He hasn't even buttered his bread roll yet. So far, so good. In my opinion, the job at Leonidas Sports would be the perfect career move for you. You're a former sportsman. It's a sporting goods company. You love to play golf. Leonidas Sports has a whole golfware line. Clive raises his eyebrows.
You've done your research on me at any rate.
I'm interested in people, I say honestly. And knowing your profile, it seems to me that Leonidas Sports is exactly what you need at this stage. This is a fantastic, unique opportunity to... Is that man your lover? A familiar, clipped voice interrupts me and I jump. That sounded just like... No, don't be ridiculous. I take a deep breath and resume. As I was saying, this is a fantastic opportunity to take your career to the next level. I'm sure that we could achieve a very generous package. I said, is that man your lover? The voice is more insistent, and before I can stop myself, I swivel my head. No, this can't be happening. She's back. It's Sadie, perched on a nearby cheese trolley. She's not in the green dress anymore. She's wearing a pale pink one with a dropped waistband and a matching coat over the top. There's a black band around her head, and from one of her wrists dangles a little grey silk bag on a beaded chain. The other hand is resting on a glass cheese dome, apart from her fingertips, which have sunk into it. She suddenly notices and pulls them out sharply, carefully positioning them on top of the glass. He's not terribly handsome, is he? I want some champagne, she adds imperiously, her eyes lighting on my drink. Ignore her. It's a hallucination. It's all in your head.
Lara, are you okay?
Sorry, Clive. I hastily turn back. Just got a bit distracted there. By the cheese trolley. It all looks so delicious. Oh, God. Clive doesn't seem amused. I need to get things back on track, quick. The real question to ask yourself, Clive, is this. I lean forward intently. Will an opportunity like this come along again? It's a unique chance to work with a great brand, to use all your proven talents and admired leadership skills. I want some champagne! To my horror, Sadie has materialized right in front of me. She reaches for my glass and tries to pick it up, but her hand goes through it. Drat! I can't pick it up. She reaches again, and again, then glares at me crossly. This is so irritating! Stop it! I hiss furiously.
I'm sorry.
Clive knits his heavy brows. Not you, Clive. Just got something caught in my throat. I grab my glass and take a gulp of water. Have you found my necklace yet? Sadie demands accusingly. No, I mutter from behind my glass. Go away. Then why are you sitting here? Why aren't you looking for it? Clive. I desperately try to focus back on him. I'm so sorry about that. What was I saying?
Admired leadership skills,
says Clive, without cracking a smile. That's right. Admired leadership skills. So the point is, haven't you looked anywhere? She thrusts her head close to mine. Don't you care about finding it? So, what I'm trying to say is, it's taking every ounce of willpower to ignore Sadie and not bat her away. In my opinion, this job is a great strategic move. It's a perfect springboard for your future. And furthermore, you've got to find my necklace. It's important. It's very, very... Furthermore, I know the generous benefits package will... Stop ignoring me! Sadie's face is practically touching mine. Stop talking! Stop! Shut up and leave me alone! Shit. Did that just come out of my mouth? From the shell-shocked way Clive's froggy eyes have widened, I'm guessing the answer is yes. At two neighbouring tables, conversations have come to a halt, and I can see our supercilious waiter pausing to watch. The buzz of clashing cutlery and conversation seems to have died away all around. Even the lobsters seem to be lined up at the edge of the tank watching. Clive! I give a strangled laugh. I didn't mean... Obviously, I wasn't talking to you.
Lara?
Clive fixes me with a hostile gaze.
Please do me the courtesy of telling me the truth.
I can feel my cheeks staining red. I was just... I clear my throat desperately. What can I say? I was talking to myself. No. I was talking to a vision. No.
I'm not a fool.
He cuts me off contemptuously.
This isn't the first time this has happened to me.
It isn't. I peer at him, bemused.
I've had to put up with it in board meetings, in directors' lunches. It's the same everywhere. Blackberries are bad enough, but these hands-free sets are a bloody menace. You know how many car accidents people like you cause.
Hands-free? Does he mean... He thinks I was on the phone. I wasn't, I begin automatically, then stop myself. Being on the phone is the most sane option available to me. I should go with it.
But this really is the pits.
He glowers at me, breathing heavily.
Taking a call during a one-to-one lunch, hoping I might not notice. It's fucking disrespectful.
I'm sorry, I say humbly. I'll switch it off now. With a fumbling hand, I reach up to my ear and pretend to switch off an earpiece.
Where is it anyway?
He frowns at me.
I can't see it.
It's tiny, I say hastily. Very discreet.
Is it the new Nokia?
He's peering more closely at my ear. Shit. It's actually, embedded in my earring. I hope I sound convincing. New technology. Clive, I'm really sorry I was distracted. I misjudged the situation, but I am very sincere about wanting to place you with Leonidas Sports. So if I could maybe just recap on what I was trying to say.
You have to be joking.
But...
You think I'm going to do business with you now?
He gives a short, unamused laugh.
You're as unprofessional as your partner, and that's saying something.
To my horror, he pushes back his chair and gets to his feet.
I was going to give you a chance, but forget it.
No, wait, please, I say in panic, but he's already striding away between the tables of gawping diners. I feel hot and cold as I stare at his empty chair. With a still shaky hand, I reach for my champagne and take three deep gulps. So that's that. I've fucked up. My best hope is gone. And anyway, What did he mean? I'm as unprofessional as my partner. Has he heard about Natalie disappearing off to Goa? Does everyone know?
Will the gentleman be returning?
My trance is interrupted by the waiter approaching the table. He's holding a wooden platter, bearing a dish with a silver dome on it. I don't think so. I stare at the table, my face burning with humiliation.
Shall I return his food to the kitchen?
Do I still have to pay for it?
Unfortunately, madam, yes.
He gives me a patronizing smile.
Since it has been ordered, and everything is cooked from fresh...
Then I'll have it.
All of it?
He seems taken aback. Yes. I lift my chin mutinously. Why not? I'm paying for it. I might as well eat it.
Very good.
The waiter inclines his head, deposits the platter in front of me, and removes the silver dome.
Half a dozen fresh oysters on crushed ice.
I've never eaten oysters in my life. I've always thought they looked gross. Close up, they look even grosser, but I'm not admitting that. Thanks, I say curtly. The waiter retreats, and I stare fixedly at the six oysters in front of me. I'm determined to see this stupid lunch out. But there's a tight, pressing feeling behind my cheekbones, and my bottom lip would be trembling if I allowed it.
Oysters! I adore oysters!
To my disbelief, Sadie appears in front of my eyes again. She sinks into Clive's vacated chair with a languid, sideways movement, looks around, and says, "This place is rather fun. Is there a cabaret?" "I can't hear you," I mutter savagely. "I can't see you. You don't exist. I'm going to the doctor and getting some drugs and getting rid of you."
"Where's your lover gone?"
"He wasn't my lover," I snap in low tones. "I was trying to do business with him, and it's all spoiled because of you. You've ruined everything. Everything." "Oh." She arches her eyebrows unrepentantly. "I don't see how I could do that if I don't exist." "Well, you did. And now I'm stuck with these stupid oysters that I don't want and can't afford, and I don't even know how to eat them."
"It's easy to eat an oyster."
"No, it isn't." I suddenly notice a blonde woman in a print dress at the next table, nudging the perfectly groomed woman next to her and pointing at me. I'm talking to thin air. I look like a lunatic. Hastily, I reach for a bread roll and start to butter it, avoiding Sadie's eye.
"Excuse me."
The woman leans over and smiles at me. "I couldn't help overhearing your conversation. I don't mean to interrupt, but did you just say your phone's embedded in your earring?" I stare back at her, my mind scrabbling for an answer other than yes. "Yes," I say at last. The woman claps a hand to her mouth. "That's amazing. How does it work?" "It has a special chip. Very new. Japanese. I have to get one." She's gazing at my Claire's Accessories £5.99 earring, awestruck. "Where do they sell them?" "Actually, this is a prototype," I say hurriedly. "They'll be available in a year or so."
"Well, how did you get one, then?"
She gives me an aggressive look. "I, know Japanese people. Sorry."
"Could I see?"
She holds out her hand. "Could you take it out of your ear for a moment? Would you mind?" "A call's just coming in," I say hastily. "It's vibrating."
"I can't see anything."
She's peering incredulously at my ear. "It's very subtle," I say desperately. "They're micro-vibrations. Hello? Matt? Yes, I can talk." I mime apologies to the woman, and reluctantly she returns to her meal. I can see her pointing me out to all her friends.
"What are you talking about?"
Sadie's eyeing me disdainfully. "How can a telephone be in an earring? It sounds like a riddle."
"I don't know.
Don't you start quizzing me, too." I prod an oyster with little enthusiasm. "Do you really not know how to eat an oyster?" "Never eaten one before in my life." Sadie shakes her head disapprovingly. "Pick up your fork," The shellfish fork. Go on. Casting her a suspicious look, I do as she says. Ease it around. Make sure it's detached from the shell. Now give it a squeeze of lemon and pick it up. Like this. She mimes picking up an oyster, and I copy. Head back and swallow the whole thing. Bottoms up. It's like swallowing a piece of jellified sea. Somehow I manage to slurp down the whole thing, grab my glass and take a swig of champagne. You see? Sadie is watching me greedily. Isn't that too delicious? It's okay, I say reluctantly. I put my glass down and survey her silently for a moment. She's reclining on the chair as though she owns the place, one arm flung to the side, her beaded bag dangling down. She's all in my head, I tell myself. My subconscious has invented her. Except my subconscious doesn't know how to eat an oyster. Does it? What is it? She juts out her chin. Why are you looking at me like that? My brain is edging very slowly to a conclusion. To the only possible conclusion. You're a ghost, aren't you? I say at last. You're not a hallucination. You're a proper, real, live ghost. Sadie gives a remote shrug, as though she's really not interested in this conversation. Aren't you? Again, Sadie doesn't reply. Her head is tilted, and she's examining her fingernails. Maybe she doesn't want to be a ghost. Well, too bad. She is. You are a ghost. I know you are. So, what, am I psychic? My head is prickling all over as this revelation hits me. I feel a bit shivery. I can talk to the dead. Me, Lara Lington. I always knew there was something different about me. Think of the implications. Think what this means. Maybe I'll start talking to more ghosts. Lots of ghosts. Oh, my God. I could have my own TV show. I could go around the world. I could be famous. I have a sudden vision of myself on a stage, channeling spirits while an audience watches avidly. With a surge of excitement, I lean across the table. Do you know any other dead people you could introduce me to? No. Sadie folds her arms crossly. I don't. Have you met Marilyn Monroe? Or Elvis? Or Princess Diana? What's she like? Or Mozart? I feel almost dizzy as possibilities pile into my head. This is mind-blowing. You have to describe it. You have to tell me what it's like. There.
Where?
Sadie tosses her chin. There. You know. I haven't been anywhere. She glares at me. I haven't met anybody. I wake up and it's as though I'm in a dream. A very bad dream. Because all I want is my necklace. But the only person who can understand me refuses to help me. She looks so accusing, I feel a surge of indignation. Well, maybe if you didn't come along and ruin everything, that person might want to help you. Did you think of that?
I didn't ruin everything.
Yes, you did.
I taught you how to eat an oyster, didn't I? I didn't want to know how to eat a bloody oyster. I wanted my candidate not to walk out.
For a moment, Sadie looks cornered. Then her chin juts out again.
I didn't know he was your candidate. I thought he was your lover.
Well, my business is probably sunk now, and I can't afford any of this stupid food. It's all a disaster, and it's all your fault.